This audio is provided without charge by Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, which reserves all rights. Please visit givewts.com to learn how you can support Westminster or contact communications at wts.edu for more information.
We come to verses 21 to 48 and what is unhelpfully called the antitheses. You have heard it was said, but I say to you, and it's not really a great term, but that's what people call them. What is Jesus talking about? And how is he saying this in a way that doesn't undercut the authority of the Old Testament? Let's start with verse 38. Let's take one example and let's see what he's doing here. Let's start with verse 38 of chapter 5. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil, but if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile with him, or go with him 2 miles, give to the one who begs from you and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. So what is Jesus saying here? What is he contrasting? When he's, it's the second time this happened. All right. I was too loud. That was. He's like a hobbit. He can get in very quietly. Get out very quietly. You know, that's true about hobbits. He's a burglar. Thank you. That's right. First time he was lifting up my book, and I thought it was a hobbit. And the second time it was a hobbit. I mean, as a compliment, Sam. Okay. All right. What does it mean? How does Jesus say, I'm not undercutting the Old Testament authority, and yet what he says is, you have heard it said, but I say to you. First thing you want to do is figure out, what does it mean when somebody slaps you on the right cheek? Well, if we were to draw a person here, I can draw a person. All right? And so, right, left. We good so far? Somebody slaps you on the right cheek, they're either hitting you with left hand, or more likely, and this is the back of the hand, an insult. Okay, so what we're probably looking at here is not somebody getting beat up, but somebody being disrespected. Boom. Back of the hand. And this is an honor-shame culture, meaning that if you lost your honor, you're losing a lot. And so, whenever somebody disrespects you in an honor and shame culture, what does Jesus say? Don't worry about it, basically. Turn to them the other cheek also. The point is, even if you have been wronged, the principle eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth is not to be your guiding ethic. Now, what was eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? Well, it comes from the Old Testament, doesn't it? And what it says is, if somebody steals a piece of gum, I don't think they had gum, let's just use that, steals a piece of gum from you, you can't take all their children. There's a law of just retributions. You might see, here's some more Latin, is that okay? You might see this sometimes. Lex talionis. Sounds like a villain from Superman, but it means law of the talon. Law of just retributions. So I only mention this because if you ever hear the lex talionis, this is what it's talking about, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What it says is that it's the law of just proportions. And so if you lose an ox, if somebody kills an ox, you get their ox. Somebody takes an eye, you take an eye. Somebody takes a tooth, you take a tooth. But this was actually for civil disputes. This is the way that their court system was set up. It was never intended for somebody to say, hey, man, give me my ox. It was designed to go through the right channels, the proper channels. And what Jesus says, you're not supposed to use this principle as a way for you to respond if you've been wronged. And so it's not that he's abrogating the Old Testament. He's saying this is not the way you use it in the first place. But he is making sure that we understand that he's teaching something different. He's saying that you don't resist at all. It's more than just about nonviolence. It's just about honor and shame and standing on your rights whenever you think that you have something to stand on. He says the point is, don't resist. And if someone would sue you and take your tunic, get the other one as well. The point is, it's a whole flipping on its head the ethics of the world. And there is a love beyond limits in one sense here, where we don't just look to what can we get for ourselves, but what can we do for the other person. And as I've mentioned, there's also a Christological connection here, because Christ was wrongfully accused, wrongfully spit upon, wrongfully slapped, but he bore with it because of the greater good. He bore with it because he knew that he was enduring it for the benefit of others. So it's not always then just about, this is not just about when somebody hits you with the back of their hand on the right cheek, here's what you do. I mean, how many times will we face that in our lifetimes? Probably not very many, is it? Probably. But the principles we encounter all the time. So you see why Bobby says, this is not just about, okay, now here's what you do when somebody slaps you on the right cheek with the back of their hand. This is about, here's what you do when somebody wrongs you. Here's what it looks like to follow Christ whenever you've been dishonored. Whenever you want retaliation. He says, leave room for the action of God. Don't seek your own vengeance. Don't retaliate violently or in any way. There's a point of this. Let God be the judge. And in Isaiah 50, for example, we see the example of Jesus. And so the fact that Jesus did not come to abrogate the law but to fulfill it means that he is showing us that what they had heard was not really what it was about. So how does Jesus not undercut the authority of the Old Testament law when he says, you've heard, but I say to you. Well, notice that he says, you have heard, not it is written. There's actually a distinction there. You have heard. You have heard this law means thus and such. You have heard people apply the law in this or that way. You have heard it said, perhaps, that's not even in the Old Testament, hate your enemy. But Jesus is correcting misinterpretations. He's not saying, it is written, but I'm going to fix that. Jesus never disagrees with the Old Testament. He never says the Old Testament is wrong. He says, you have heard it was said. You have heard this was about this. You have heard it to do this or that or the other. He says, no, that's not quite right. In fact, sometimes he deepens it to show us that what that was really about and what I'm telling you that's about is something deeper than you thought it was. The law is good because it reflects God's character. The problem is never with the law per se. The problem is with our sin that brings about death in the face of God's law. And the problem in Jesus' discussion here is also misinterpretations of the law, misappropriations of the law. And so he doesn't just repeat the old. He doesn't contradict the old, but he doesn't just repeat the old. He says now the goal is to treat others the way that we want to be treated, which he says you can actually get from the Old Testament, but it's not the way that people often interpreted the Old Testament. So the point, I think, is fairly clear. Paul picks up on the same point in Romans 12. We are not to be the judge, but we are to leave room for the wrath of God. Our job is to live at peace with all people. And that is the principle. Any self-defense or retaliation is not our job. We are to leave room for God's wrath, God's judgment, God's action. And so that's to understand, turn the other cheek, is to understand what it meant in that day and then understand how that's one example of what it might look like to not retaliate when wrong. Don't resist or claim your rights, is what Jesus is saying, but do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, what's interesting is, this one's a rather tame one, I guess you could say. You can But some of them are a little more extreme. Look, for example, at the first part of it here, in verse 29. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than your whole body go into hell. What do you do with that? Are we downplaying the words of Jesus if we don't lop off hands or poke out eyes? This is a principle, right? And so it's not every situation means that you're going to be hit on with the back of the hand on the right cheek. But what about this other one? It says, cut it off, poke it out. How do we take that seriously? Yeah, I mean, how do we take that seriously? And how does that relate to physical mutilation? I mean, that's the question. What should we be reverting to or going to that length, the physical mutilation, if it means greater holiness? Well, if it meant greater holiness, right? But does it? What's Jesus' point? Does he really want us to amputate hands? I mean, this is a very visceral question. Does he want you to amputate your hand, literally? I'm seeing both answers. Who says yes? Or who wants to just say yes, just for sake of argument? Or who wants to say no for sake of argument? What about it, Susan?
I want to say no.
Okay.
I think he's making the point that it's so important that you, you should even think of it.
And what basis do you think he's not meaning it physically? If I can put it that way.
First of all, I'm not sure exactly which verse that is, so I'm scrambling.
29. 29,
okay.
5:29. I believe, am I right?
Yes, sir. You say it.
Because we don't want to not take Jesus seriously. Correct? We want to take him seriously.
He is pointing out it would be better that you do that than to go to hell. But that's not necessary in order to not go to hell.
Okay. Who else? All right, Mark.
I mean, from other places in the Bible, we know that the hand and the eyes are not the seat where sin comes from. So it's the heart of the issue. And so, first of all, just doing that is not going to remove the sin. Doing this thing is not going to change your heart disposition. And so the sin will just manifest itself in a new way, and you're going to end up with just a torso by the end. But your heart's still going to be wrong. And so I think clearly knowing that clearly that's not where sin comes from, so he can't be saying that that's the source of the sin, just the eye or the hand. And but he's saying wherever there's easier form of where temptation is easier. It's like you want to avoid any situations where temptation is easier. And that might mean giving up certain things that are good for the sake of avoiding temptations. So like a modern day example would be like, the beach is a good thing, but for people who might struggle with lust, they might want to give up the beach, which is a good thing for the sake of not wanting temptation to be so easy.
All right, and so those are both on the same perspective. What about a different perspective? You may have a different one. Nobody. Not a dissenting, but you go ahead. Yeah.
I like Ferguson's sentence that said he sort of had a dialogue that someone would say to God at that point, and he said it's like somebody saying anything but my eye, Lord, anything, and then that's what God might be calling you to do, sort of the same thing. But anyway, I like the way Ferguson worded it.
So everybody's taking the easy way out. nobody thinks it's literal. Yeah,
I don't really think it's literal, but just the argument, as you said. And I do agree that it says, not your physical body, but your heart, where it's sitting, might be like the starting point. But if you didn't have a part of your body to sin with, even if you're getting that motivation, you wouldn't be, you you have a problem with shoplifting and you don't have hands, maybe you need to even go to that, you know, you can think about it, but you never cross your mind to do it. So I don't know to like what extent you say this. I don't disagree with what other people said. Maybe there's something to it.
I think that a tendency is not to for a lot of people, maybe not people in this room, but for a lot of people, is to not laugh it off, but just kind of be like, oh, well, that was strange, without really wrestling with the force of it. Because the force of this is very strong. The force of this is supposed to make us think, whoa, really? Well, what are you saying? The force of this is to get us to stop and kind of go, you know, like that's pretty extreme. And so it doesn't mean that if we don't cut off our hands, we're not taking Jesus literally. That means that to take him according to the sense that he intends is to do what he intends us to do with that statement, which means what extreme do you have to go to fight off sin because it's that important? Because if we look at the alternative, there's no contest. And so, I mean, look at the disciples. They didn't go around with, you know, tongues cut off and hands broken off or whatever because of sin. But what we see is that they model for us what it looks like to follow Christ in this age, and it's a matter of the heart. And the point is, though, what is it in life that would cause us to be distracted from the goal of following Christ? And whatever that is, if it's in danger of leading us astray, of causing us to stumble definitively, then let's cut it out and get rid of it. And so there's a balance there. So we don't just kind of say, oh, that was odd. We wrestle. I mean, his point is not that you take out a saw. But his point is that should make us stop and think, he really means this. This is a prophetic hyperbole that you find Jesus giving. Which means that you better take this seriously, because I'm giving you a serious warning. Whatever it is that's causing you to hold back from following me, cut it out and get rid of it. Because the goal is that's held out before you is eternal life, and the other option is eternal separation from God. And another thing to remember as well is there's no dichotomy in the Bible between the body and soul. I mean, we're whole people. And so our spiritual life and our physical life are intertwined. You know, so what we do with our hands, what we do with our bodies, that's part of who we are as spiritual beings, if I can put it that way. And so one of the presuppositions may be your body is an indication of the soul. Take care of your body. Make sure your body is serving Christ and not serving sin. I mean, Paul speaks in similar ways as well. Don't offer the members of your body as instruments of unrighteousness or instruments of sin, but as instruments of righteousness. Now, well, this leads to another question. And let's look here at verse 27. It's the same context. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. You all know the passage. Here's the question. Does Jesus teach in the Sermon on the Mount that no sin is any worse than any other sin? Probably get a mixture of opinion on that one. Does Jesus teach that no sin is any better or worse? Better is not the right word. Is any worse than any other sin? Okay.
Oh, Kelly, sorry.
Kelly, I'm sorry. I said
no,
Kate.
That's okay.
I'm Kelly.
I would say no. Well, okay. Any sin itself, no, because falling short of righteousness is falling short of righteousness, and the wages of sin is death. But there are sins, like how he talks about to teachers, that they need to be careful what they teach, because it might, like, there are sins where when you act and actually do that, it causes other people to sin, or it, I don't know, like doing something in your heart only affects you versus doing something else also hurts other people. So it kind of is, know.
Well, he says here that if you lusted after a woman, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. Right? So just to follow up with your response, what would you say to that? I mean, how do you address that?
I agree. I mean, that's what he says, so that's what it is. But I think that that's true, that the sin, like, looking lustfully is the same as having committed it in terms of your own heart and your own sinfulness. Those sins are the same. But in terms of the consequences that might lead to revenge from her husband, that's probably not going to happen in both of those situations.
All right. Amy?
Yeah, I was just going to say that she
did. But is it the same perspective or different perspective?
Same and different. I think Kelly is trying to say that the sins are the same. They're all sins, and it leads to death. But it's kind of different. And I wanted to point out the reason why it's different is that Jesus does not talk about each sin using the same, the same sort of severity or in his language. So with lust, after he talks about adultery, he talks about cutting off your, your limbs or your right hand, otherwise, because you don't want your whole body to go into hell. But he does not mention, going into hell in every single one of them. Like, for example, the turning the other cheek. He doesn't say that, I guess. That's...
Does he have to?
Oh, okay.
who has a different perspective? Eric?
Well, I don't know if it's different, but I think in perspective of the kingdom...
Everybody agrees? Does everybody agree on everything?
I think something to add to it is, in perspective of the kingdom and the king, God looks at lust or adultery, it's still a grave offense against God. So, I mean, if you're looking at it from a kingdom perspective, God sees sin as sin. There's no such thing as a sin in God's eyes if that's a lesser grave. Sin is sin. It's an utter offense, no matter what it is against God. So in that way, there's no... But we here, there's different consequences to it.
All right.
I want us to look at it from a kingdom perspective.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, let me add another element to the conversation. You're a counselor. You may think about doing that. I'm a man. I'll just use a man example. There's a man who says he struggles with lust. Then there's a man who says he is cheating on his wife. Are those the same things? All right, Jeannie.
No, I mean they're the same heart issue, but it's the fact that one acts on it and one doesn't, which actually creates the consequence and creates the impact on somebody else. So it's like, and it also makes sense how God, like, there are different levels of sin because we're impacted by different levels of sin, and so God, we're like His creation. If somebody, abuses me physically, that's going to be different than somebody gossiping about me. So I think across the board, there's definitely different levels of sin. And I think God will reward us for that differently. Because I think one requires a commitment. And I know that's the argument with faith and works, too, but I think if we're equipped by the Spirit, we can do God's work. So it's not in our own.
Innate ability?
Yeah. In our ability that we do this, it's because we're equipped by the Spirit. But there's accountability and, there's a lot to it.
All right. Denise?
I've talked with two different women, and one's her husband cheated on her, and the other one's her husband had a problem with pornography. And their reactions are the same. Betrayal. They feel like they're unworthy. They're not good enough. But on the flip side, then, when you think your husband is cheating on you, and then when you find out he is, there are two different things also. I mean, I'm not saying the sin, I think sin is sin. I don't know if I agree with you that there are different levels of sin. I just think sin is sin. So, those are my experiences, and it hurts, and I think that the two things in here, God talks about judgment when he talks to you about anger, Jesus does, and then when he talks about lust, he talks about hell. So, what strikes me about that is that when you do those two things, you're ruining the community around you. And I think God really cares about his people and how they relate to each other and how they relate to him. So that's what I think about all that.
All right. What's interesting is, if I were to ask that, Carly.
I was going to kind of take the opposite.
Okay.
This is like a very proof text way of going about it, but there is a verse in John, I think, where Jesus says, "He who has delivered me over has actually committed the greater sin," which is an interesting statement if there isn't a scale. And the other thing I was thinking, I'm not as confident about this one, but in James, there's kind of this progression of sin where you have a desire that is conceived and gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. And I think that progression might be an indication that there's a difference between, there's always going to be temptation, but then there's a desire, and then that desire actually progresses into sin and then to death. So I think that can be a stronger case for saying there are maybe varying degrees.
Right? Marianne?
I'm right. Actually, the way...
I'm sorry, did I get a name wrong?
Marianne.
I'm sorry. Yes, yes,
I think the way the church responds to different sins, if a man had a struggle with pornography, I think if he was unrepentant about it, that would be one thing, but if he was really struggling with it, you would probably walk with him and get him counseling and help and that kind of thing. If a man committed adultery, he'd probably be excommunicated. And if a woman said, "Hey, my husband, his eyes linger on women too long," you wouldn't say, "Yeah, it's okay to dissolve that marriage. He's broken his marriage vow." But if he were committing adultery as often as he let his eyes stray, you might say yes. So I think the way the church would respond would say there.
What's interesting is if I ask the question, if we talk about this one, we get a lot of different answers. It's maybe not get the same answer if I say, is hating someone in your heart the same as murdering somebody? Ransom.
So I have to say kind of yes and no. To a degree, it's a question of, well, same in what respect? So yes, they're both the same in that they're sin before God and they're deserving of the wrath and condemnation of God, no matter how big or small your sin. There's that issue of justice that is deserved. And, both sins are deserving of hell. And the separation that results from God is needed. We can't, little sin, big sin, we can't bridge that gap to God once it's there on our own. I think there are, I don't want to just flat out say everything is exactly the same. Carly mentioned the passage of James. There's also the passage in 1 Corinthians where 1 Corinthians 6, it talks about sexual sin. All other sins are outside of a man's body. Sexual sin. There's some kind of thing there that's communicating something different, where God talks about, well, if the signs and wonders that had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, instead of you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. And as a result, your punishment's going to be worse. Which is some kind of language of gradation or differential. I'm uncomfortable with the idea of drawing up a list and saying, here's the number, the 10 levels of hell. But I think there is a sense in which, there are some things that are more serious, but I'm not sure that I'm comfortable I'm not sure there's a really good way to quantify that, or you know, really get my hands on that.
Hmm.
So it's not really much of a clear answer.
To both end.
But yeah.
Let me mention why I'm mentioning this, because I think for a couple of reasons I think it's an important question, not just one that's just fun or interesting to discuss. But I think that we can fall off the horse on one of two sides here. One to say, well, you know, whatever, can't do any of it, and one that that says, well, what was the other side of the horse? So one that says we can't do any of it, and one that says, well, Jesus is just kind of speaking too strongly here. But we got to hold a couple of things together. One, Jesus is showing us that sin is deeper than we thought it was. That sin is a matter of the heart. And that you might think you can get away with not just maybe committing adultery, but he says, it's actually deeper than that. You've got a problem with that even if you just had the wrong thought, because our hearts need to be completely pure and set apart to God. We might think that we're okay if we're not murdering somebody. I mean, we really think we're better than other people then, don't we? I'm not murdering anybody. But he says, actually, if you've had the murderous thought in your heart, you have the same problem. And so Jesus is showing us that the issue goes deeper into the heart than we thought it might, and that it is, in fact, an internal thing, not just an external thing. But you also have the statement that some of them mentioned. Jesus gets on to the Pharisees for neglecting the weightier matters of the law. And there are, John 19 talks about some sins are worse than others. And that there is a difference, and let's just use, maybe this is a more obvious example, between killing somebody and just thinking a bad thought about that person, you know, like an evil thought. And they're both sins, and they're all in God's sight require punishment. But it is different if the marriage bond is broken through a physical act of adultery rather than a lustful thought. Those are our different things in terms of what it does, for example, to the marriage covenant. And so this is where I'm coming from. The Westminster standards do recognize a difference. And let me show you what they say. It's actually a rather long, it doesn't give you a list, and I think that's a helpful comment, that we don't have a list. But we do know that there are, or at least I'm convinced that we know that there are differences. And let me just show you what some of the thoughts are here. So I don't know if you can see this or not, if you want to see it. But starting with question 150, this is the larger catechism. Are all transgressions of the law of God equally heinous in themselves and in the sight of God? The answer is no. Some sins in themselves and by reason of several aggravations are more heinous in the sight of God than others. Well, it says, well, how do you figure that out? Well, sins receive their aggravations, one from the person's offending. If somebody is more mature, has greater experience of grace, is eminent for profession, gifts, place, office, guide to others, somebody is famous, somebody's a teacher, a leader, then it's worse if they stumble. From the party's offended, if it's immediately against God, that's as bad as you can get. Against Christ, against his attributes, against the Holy Spirit, his witnesses and working. So if you're blaspheming God, that's incredibly. So it gives us some examples here. And then number three, from the nature or the quality of the offense. If it is against the express letter of the law, break many commandments, contains many sins, not only conceived in the heart, but breaks forth in word and actions. If it scandalizes others, causes them to stumble, admit of no reparation. If against means, mercies, judgments, light of nature, conventions, public or so it goes on and on here about some of the things that according to Scripture seem to indicate there are different levels. That's Westminster Larger Catechism 151 if you're interested in looking at it. But the point is that there are all sins. One thing that Jesus is saying is that all sins are worthy of judgment. But also things that we may not think are a big deal, even those are a big deal. Those are worthy of judgment. But he's not just saying, let me go to an extreme here. Let me just be saying, well, if you have the lustful thought, go ahead and act on it. I mean, of course, Jesus would never say that, but it's not intending to give us that impression. Or if you have an evil thought, just go ahead and, you know, do something. It's because it doesn't matter anyway. That's not his point. It's not that it doesn't matter anyway. I think that there can be a lack of motivation sometimes in Christian living. If we think, well, nothing I do matters anyway. But that's not really the way that Jesus is talking about it here. Because, you know, I mentioned the point earlier about filthy rags. Well, everything we do is just filthy rags. Well, no, that's actually not true. That's about fake worship in the Old Testament. That's not about spirit-wrought obedience in the New Testament. That's about hypocrites, basically. But our deeds are good works that God prepared in advance that we should walk in them, in Ephesians 2:10. And although we are not saved, what's interesting is to read Ephesians 2:10 in light of Ephesians 2:8 and 9, where he says, we are saved by grace through faith, not by works, lest anyone should boast, because we were created for good works. So if you read that very quickly, you think, well, but there's a distinction there, is that we are not saved by good works, but we are saved in order that we should walk in good works, that we should do them, that we should bear fruit. And so there is growth in holiness. There is the power of the Spirit to help us to walk in the way that Christ commands. And therefore, we should not be so discouraged in the Christian life that we think, well, a murderous thought is just as bad as murdering somebody. Oh, you know, what can I do right? But there is, Jesus' point is, everything's a problem with the heart. And even those little things, so-called, are not really that little. You've got to deal with them. But he's not just wiping out every distinction, because I do think we still see those distinctions between weightier matters of the law, deeper sins, or more heinous sins, as the confession puts it, than others. And so the whole point is that murder is... both murder and the hateful thought, both adultery and the lustful thought, all of these are sinful because they get at the heart. And he wants us to look at the deeper point of the law, which is not just the external, but it's to understand that it goes right to the heart. And that is, I think, a large part of the key to understanding how we take these antitheses. And you have heard it said, it's not really what it's about, Jesus said. Here's what it's about. Here's how we should understand it in light of the kingdom. All right, we've got a few minutes here. What I want to do is practice this. Practice what? No, not practice the sins, but practice the reflection on how we look through the external to get at the heart of the issue. And so we looked at 538 to 42 for a few minutes. There's five more of them. So I would like for you, now this may be the hard part, is to figure out how to get into five groups. I know in the past we've had more than five, so... Five groups. I think we should be about six, maybe seven per group, if you can. And we'll. What I want. I'll break these up. 5:21 to 26, 5:27 to 30, 5:31 to 32, and on. And I'll come by and drop one on your group and tell you which one it is. But I'm gonna put some questions up here, and this is a way for us to discuss these. One of the things I want to ask is, what is the Old Testament back? You have heard it was said. Well, where does that come from? Where did they hear it was said from? Where does that come from? And are there examples of this in the Old Testament? And secondly, what is the real issue Jesus wants to focus on? You know, the swearing of the oath. What is it about the oath? What's he trying to get at? Why is this a big deal? And what is the positive thing we are to see and to do from this? And thirdly, how does Jesus' teaching, Jesus' role as prophet, priest, and king, Jesus as Messiah, how does this affect our understanding of this command? And then fourthly, what does that mean? What are some ways we apply this, given that they're general, not specific, perhaps? How are we to apply this where we are? Is that clear? Yes.
Number two, what is the positive way we are to fulfill it?
Yes, we're to do it. So not just don't hate somebody, but what are we supposed to do? All right, so let's divide into five groups, and I will go in order on these and assign each group a text. All right, let's discuss these for a few minutes. Trying to look at the main issue that Jesus would have us focus on is basically what we're trying to do and figure out what that looks like in life. Now, the first one was murder. And the group up here in the front had that one. Can you say a little bit about the Old Testament background and all those questions that we had there? Who's a spokesman for front group? To help? Spokeswoman.
We have a bunch of examples from the Old Testament being refuge, Cain's anger being rebuked even before he murdered Abel, the instructions for Noah about not shedding blood in Genesis 9, Moses being judged for striking the rock, Jonah's anger against the Ninevites and against God.
And of course, the basic command as well. Those are all of the Ten Commandments. That one comes from the Ten Commandments as well. Yeah. All right, here you say it. Good. All right. And what is the issue that Jesus is trying to get us to see? So plenty of people could say, I haven't murdered, right? Most people could say that. So what was the real issue he's trying to get us to see?
We said that anger towards someone is really hatred for that person and reflects their anger towards God.
And what? How did you all make that connection between anger towards God?
Talks about that puts yourself in the judge position. You're judging that you know.
You're taking the vengeance. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jonah's
right. Yeah. Jonah didn't like what God said. What about the second part of that second question? What are we supposed to do? Now, that may have been awkward way to phrase it, but the question is, what positive thing are we supposed to do? Then, not just don't murder, okay, put down the sword, but what are we supposed to do?
Seek reconciliation and love people.
And where do we see the reconciliation? You see it in the text, I guess, pretty obviously. And you say, and love people? Which is a very easy thing to say, isn't it? To love. I mean, we all know Jesus says to love, but sometimes you feel like murdering somebody. I mean, not to overstate it, but sometimes there's very real. I mean, Jesus is going to say even love your enemies, because they're your enemies, which is a shocking thing to say. So don't just love those who do good for you. But so yeah, it can be very hard to love somebody you're angry at, and that's what he says to do. What practical ways? Or we haven't got to number three yet, have we? How does Jesus show us this, or how does his coming affect our understanding of it?
In his incarnation, death, he modeled the length which we should go to achieve reconciliation. That's what he did here.
Good, right.
He died for sinners. There was nothing killing about us. That we have to be willing to suffer and not demand our rights.
Good.
At the cross, Father's time, Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Good, right. Even those that were, that didn't deserve to hear that said about. Well, and was that number four as well, what you were just mentioning, some of those things, some practical ways?
We had the Lord's Supper, like think about this, if we participate in the Lord's Supper. And also dealing with anger right away and not letting it develop into this root of bitterness, which takes it to a new level.
Yeah. Good. What about the next group who had 5:27-30? The one we talked about a little bit, I guess we talked a little bit about murder as well, the one on adultery and lust. Is that right? 27-30, the next group? Yeah. What was the background for the command of the issue? Do we have a spokesperson?
When we talked about David and just how he, how his lust led him to adultery and then the death of his son and just the consequences of that, and it was interesting how Jesus said, like, cut off your right hand, and David's son, the right hand, was cut off, and it would have been better for David to have lost his hand than his son. And then the real issue he's kind of identified as, like, contented and not, and a person's adultery or idolatry and our twisted desires and what the real issue in that satisfaction in Christ and in God, and the positive way to fulfill that would be worshiping God and contentment in God versus desiring wrong things or desiring things too much. And then the role of Jesus affecting our understanding. We talk about how he fulfilled this, he modeled it, and that he was ultimately cut off.
How does he model it?
I think we were just talking about how he was content while he was here on Earth, even though he knew what he was going to do, and even though, like, I mean, when he asked in the garden, you know, if the cup could pass him by, you know, he was still content to fulfill, you know, the kingdom and do what he was there to do. So I think that was one way he modeled it.
I think also when he was tempted in the desert, or in the wilderness, when he was tempted in the wilderness, he was given an opportunity, right? Satan comes to him and offers him all of these things, and it is very enticing. However, you know, he knows that he has a very specific role. He has a very specific theme, purpose for which he came, and so, you know, keeping his eyes fixed on that, he's not swayed by, you know, the promises of that the world offers. And another thing that I want to add, though, is another way that he fulfills this. So Jenny mentioned how David's son was cut off as a consequence of this lustful desire, and you know, Jesus fulfilled it in that he was ultimately cut off so that we never have to wait. He fulfilled it in that way.
How about practical ways? What about some practical ways? Have you mentioned it already?
Two. First would be, you know, worship. I think worship is so, so important. And I guess it really helps us to reorient our hearts on God, on Jesus, rather than so easily being, you know, focused on other things. And another thing is community. So when David fell into this sin, he was, like, by himself when he should have been on the battlefield. Or whatever. So I think just the need for community helps keep us accountable.
And also just for God's will, like in our church communities, to be radical in fighting sin and take like active steps and take it seriously and confessing it to one another and with accountability. And,
Good. Thank you. Next group. 5:31-32.
Sure. So the first one we looked at Deuteronomy 24:1, which talks about how you can divorce. Basically, that's when he gives the permission to divorce. Moses does for unfaithful.
What's that? So the cause of indecency, right? So what does that mean as part of the debate around that passage in Deuteronomy 24, right?
And then the real issue we talked about is the idea of like abusing the law so that you can do whatever you want. It's kind of what they were doing. They were divorcing for whatever reason they wanted to, because they had permission to.
What are we to do? I mean,
what are we to do? We were saying, you know, if you're in a relationship, be reconciled, stay married. Even when adultery happens, be seeking reconciliation, putting the other person first. Kind of basically that he's saying, like, do as much as you can to stay. Like, don't be looking for reasons out. Be looking for as many reasons as you can to stay. And how does Jesus fulfill this? We said that Christ kept pursuing us, even when we were adulterous as a nation and we turned against him and we broke our covenant and we continued to break our covenant over and over again. While we were sinners, he came and died for us. And so that's sort of like they were saying, he was cut off for us. He gave everything for us. So how can we not give everything for our spouses? Practical ways to apply it. This was tricky.
This is tricky, all right.
Because we had some practical examples that people brought up that were tricky. So we were talking about, the simple answer is stay married if you're married. And then I think we said, if you're not married, just don't get married.
But no, we were saying.
Do you want to talk about your there's two cases that we brought up. I don't know if we should talk about that. One is when.
Well, we don't have to be really specific or detailed, but just general bullet points.
Yeah, so one is when a couple they got married, they were both non-Christians, but after they got married, one became a Christian, and the other one just still a non-believer, and the husband divorced the wife based on that. And so we were saying that how do we apply this to, basically the husband is saying that, she's an unbeliever, she's not, beneficial to my Christian walk, and therefore I divorce her. So how do we apply this to that? And so this is one example of that. And the other one is...
Which, by the way, 1 Corinthians 7 addresses explicitly.
Yeah, right.
It says don't do that. Go ahead.
Right. You're right. That's sort of what we said. And the second example is, how do we encourage someone in a marriage relationship when one of them does not want to work on the relationship? Like, there's a conflict and one person is not willing to reconcile. How do we encourage this other person to stay married and to keep reconciliation?
Yeah, of course, there's all sorts of various dimensions and permutations of what it looks like. And there's all sorts of ways to... For all of these, that you apply these, given the context. And with the last group on oaths, taking oaths. How many of you have your favorite verse, do not swear at all, above your... Not the one that maybe gets the most attention, but what did y'all find from it? We have just about 3 or 4 minutes. So what does it come from? Okay, well, what was the second question? Well, why don't we just jump to the second question in all seriousness. What is the issue that's being focused on in this one?
About keeping your word and not trying to weasel your way out of a situation by swearing on something that's less than God. And saying, I was swearing on God, so this is if I don't fall through.
Changing your story, crossing your fingers, and saying, well, that's not really what I meant, right? Yeah.
Or even swearing on things that you have no control over, like making your hair white all the time. It's kind of funny because now you can color your hair.
Yeah.
But obviously, the point is, things that are completely out of your control.
Right. And what's the point? What are we supposed to do? I mean, what's the point of it all?
Be cheerful.
Right, and let truth be characteristic of all that we do as we serve the truth. And what about Jesus' coming? What did Jesus do that shows us this?
God kept his promise.
Yeah, there you go. Is that what y'all had? I mean, yeah. Something like that? Yeah, I mean, Jesus, everything he says is true. He can even say it before he can tell you something. Amen, I say to you. He is the fulfillment of God's word, Mark.
We were wrestling with the idea of if this was in the Old Testament passages, it talks about not swearing by God's name. Don't do that and profane my name. But then here it says, like, if you do take a vow, be sure to fulfill it. And so the question is that like an allowance or a command? And Jesus here is saying, don't swear at all. But he never says, don't swear by God. He just says all these other things that aren't. So we're just confused about how that swears
with you. Well, it's confusing. I don't know if we have time to answer it right now, but it's a confusing thing. And that's why some people say, well, don't swear at all. But what he means is in your, there are commands to swear, oaths. And oaths can be lawful oaths in the Old Testament. So it's not as though he's saying all oaths are now unlawful. But he's saying, in your day-to-day business, don't go around swearing at all. I mean, that's kind of, some people say that's dodging what he's saying. But there's actually lawful oaths in the Bible. And you see Jesus basically abiding by that, and Paul basically abiding by that as well. And so there are places for it. But the point is not to be untruthful in your way of living so that you're swearing oaths to try to make yourself look better or something that you're not. But yes, it's a confusing one, absolutely. So what practical takeaways here? We have 1 minute negative to go. 5:31. What about practical? How do you do this?
I think Elizabeth said a few
Yeah. Be truthful. Be reliable. Be most dependable.
I think, like, not saying yes to things you know you can't do in order to please do. Like, I'll do it, and then your mind is saying, I'm not.
That's hard, isn't it? And one of the things that task management gurus will tell you is when you say yes to everybody, you're saying no to something else. So be sure you say yes to the right things. And that's a different issue, I guess. But all right, well, we are out of time. Thank you all, and see you next week. Good discussion.
Thank you for listening. For more information about how you can help Westminster continue to provide content like this without charge, please visit givewts.com or email us at communications@wts.com.